Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels, the Blake Radio Network, and this is Dr. Daniels. I'd like to remind people that we have a chat room going at healingwithdrdaniels.chatango.com, and if people would like to listen by calling in or if they have questions, they can call in at 914-338-0695. Well, this is a show I have wanted to do ever since I went to medical school. I always wanted to know, what would people think, what would they do if they knew what really happened in medical school? So, that's the subject of today's episode, which is Training Serial Killers for the Secret War on U.S. Soil. Yes, you heard it here. Medical schools are indeed the training ground for serial killers. And there is a secret war going on in U.S. soil. Evidence? Why, the evidence is the death of 860,000 Americans every year because they receive medical care. So a couple weeks back, we talked about the selection process that produces prime candidates for serial killers in white coats. And these serial killers are then subjected to an education process that further hones and sharpens their skills. This process, as I said, is so efficient that it results in the predictable death of 860,000 Americans every year. Now, as I've mentioned before, the Medicare Inspector General, I mean the person who inspects and investigates suspicious events, has admitted that 180,000 Medicare patients every year are murdered at the hands of their health care providers in the process, of course, of providing the standard of care. Now, this is a lot of death. Now, if you take the 860,000 Americans who die every year, this is 40 times more deadly than 9/11. And so today, I'm going to expose the medical school training ground for the secret war on U.S. soil and give you some tips about how to avoid getting caught in the crossfire. Now, this topic is so gruesome, that a little bit of levity is necessary. So, I've written lots of jokes, as many as you know, so I'm going to share them with you in great number today, because I've written quite a few about medical school itself. Now, I told you about the medical school admissions process, and so I went through that process myself, and then, when I was admitted to medical school, I went to my father and I said, Daddy, I've been admitted to medical school. And he said to me, honey, sit down. There's something you need to know. And I figured this was good news. This is not a claustrophobia. He said, you have just been admitted to Harvard, and you graduated, and now you've just been admitted to medical school. Your dream to become a doctor is assured. But there are no second chances. There's something you must know. And I said, would you go to the Ecuadorian website? I said, yes, Daddy. And he said, the medical license is a license to kill. Do not waste it. Be a surgeon. Amputate 1 inch at a time. Charge $10,000 per inch. When you amputate one leg, then start on the next leg. Don't stop until you've done both legs. You'll be driving a Rolls Royce in no time. Make me proud. And I said, oh, Dad, you're kidding. Nobody would do that. Oh, my poor father. He rolled his eyes. He turned to my mother. Her name is Lillian. And he said, Lil, talk to your daughter. And so I just, well, there was nothing more to say. I just left the room because that was just so ridiculous. Of course, nobody deliberately maimed someone just for money. That's absurd. So then I went off to medical school. And the way medical school curriculum is designed is the first 2 years in most medical schools is exclusively book work. That's biology, physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, pathophysiology, all these different book things, pharmacology. And the student never gets to see a real-life patient. That's the way medical school is set up. Now, I went to an Ivy League medical school, so they had a little more permissive. So, okay, we will allow patient contact in the first year. And so we were allowed to learn the basic physical exam, you know, kind of examining each other, fully dressed, of course. And we were also allowed to see certain patients who were very upbeat, very positive, and really excited about their medical care. We were not given a, you know, all-out tour of the hospital. And so we were very well shielded and, as just you could say, handled. And so a lot was kept from us, I now realize. And I now realize it was very important to introduce us young medical students to the lethality and the danger and the gruesomeness in a very gradual, almost seductive manner. So in that first year, what happened was we were given tours of the hospital, as I said, and certain patients were selected. And of course, they were selected for their cheerfulness and their really just total fawning adoration of the medical complex. And so, of course, I wrote a joke about this. And these two doctors are talking, and they're on the cancer ward. And the name of the cancer ward is Happy Chemo Land. And the first doctor says, what are all these beautiful young women doing on the cancer ward? And the second doctor says, oh, those are medical models. We're paying them to impersonate cancer patients enjoying their chemotherapy. Medical students are coming through today, and they might get discouraged if they saw the real thing. And so, you know, care was taken to make sure that we did not see gruesome suffering and what amounted to a total failure of the medical care system. And the next thing we were introduced to is our extreme special status as physicians. We were told that as physicians, we had a special status in society, and we had special privileges, and we were allowed to do things no one else was allowed to do. And we were accorded these special privileges because of our training and specialized knowledge that we had. And this allowed us to be of especially extreme help and benefit to patients. And so because of that, we were allowed to, you know, touch people's bodies in ways that would otherwise be considered criminal. So what happened then is we were a little uneasy about it, but they explained to us that don't worry, they selected us very specially, and we have these privileges, and as long as we followed standard of care, that would be our umbrella of protection, and we would have these privileges, and we would never fear prosecution of any kind for exercising our privileges, whatever they entail. And so, of course, I wrote a joke about that. I should say, well, come in. The nurse comes in and the office, and she says, Dr. Jones, Mr. Smith's wife called. He died suddenly last night. And the doctor looks up, and he sees this umbrella. It's labeled the standard of care. And it says, underneath, hospital privileges, licensure, malpractice laws, insurance payment guidelines, medical board certification, Nagin looks up and says, I think we're covered. And so that was really the essence of it, that patients are going to get sick, patients are going to die, and all we need to do is set the standard of care, and it is our umbrella coverage. And so this was a little disturbing to me because I had gone to medical school to learn how to help people get better, not to seek absolution from murder, and not to seek exoneration from harming people. I thought that I was going to be, you know, pretty darn helpful, you know, like Superman or something, or, you know, just some all-around good guy, so to speak. So then the concept of deadliness was exposed, revealed to us. And to me, that was very shocking that in the setting of learning to heal people, the concept of administering deadly medications was there. And so I said, well, we know a medication is deadly when it kills half of all the people who take it. I was shocked at this. Like, you mean if it kills 49% of the people who take it, then it's not deadly? And so the instructor, I said that in my mind. And so the instructor went on to tell us that this is the way to measure how safe a medicine is. Get a lethal dose. Let's say the lethal dose is 100 units. And then you have the therapeutic dose, the dose that we're trained to prescribe. Let's say the dose is 10 units. And so the ratio between the lethal dose and the prescribed dose is, in this case, tenfold, then that's a pretty safe margin of safety. But wait a minute. The dose at which half of all who take it die is 100. We don't know what percent actually die when 10 units are given. Who knows? Maybe when 10 units are given, 10% of people die, or 20%, or 30%. So we're actually given a unit that was called safety, but actually, as this Orwellian thing goes, the opposite of that, it was actually units of lethality. So the lethal dose, or the dose that was half of all who took it died, was our safety standard. And so obviously, maybe it's not obvious to you, but if you're working off the LD50, you're going to kill a lot of people. So I explained all this, and the ratio of the therapeutic dose and the lethal dose and blah, blah, blah. And so I raised my hand. I really did do this. I really raised my hand at this point because I did not sign up for murder. And I said, excuse me, professor, what about the LD0? What about the dose at which nobody died? And you could hear a pin drop. I mean, a hush went over the auditorium. It was worse than passing gas in church. The other students apparently knew something I did not know. In other words, you weren't not supposed to ask these questions. So this really happened. The professor looked at me and said, there is no such dose. Everybody, you know, dies, you know, every dose has with it the possibility of death. And for me, this was just really an unspeakable thing because I was determined not to murder people. I felt enough people died all by themselves, and I didn't need to add to it. So I wrote a little joke about that. So the professor's giving this lecture, and then, of course, there's the medical student that they meet sitting on the seat of the seat, and the professor says, well, we use LD50 studies to measure safety of drugs. And so the student says, well, what's that? And the professor says, well, LD50 is a lethal dose for 50% of those who take the drug. And so the student says, can you measure the LD0? And the professor says, there's no such thing. And the student has this big question mark. And then finally, the professor says, I am troubled by your questions. I'm recommending you spend additional 6 months of study to be sure you master the standard of care. And this is what the other students knew that I didn't know, which is when you ask these kinds of questions, it doesn't go very well with people. So I was targeted early on, but I think, I would like to think that it was not a very serious thing. So we've now been introduced to the concept of murdering the patient with drugs. However, we've been given a small out. Well, if you keep a big enough ratio between the lethal dose and the therapeutic dose, then you can give that patient a greater degree of safety. But it nagged at me a little bit that we couldn't create a situation where the patient had a zero chance of dying as a result of the therapy. And I just had to scratch my head because I just, I went to medical school to help people get better, and the concept of giving out deadly dangerous drugs was just, to me, a bit surprising. So then I made up my mind that I was going to learn everything I could to prescribe drugs safely. So, of course, that meant in pharmacology class, first of all, going to pharmacology class, which is an incredibly boring class. All they do is, list drugs and talk about the drugs, which is very, very dry. But I made up my mind I was going to memorize the brand name, the generic name, the reasons to give the drug, the reasons not to give the drug, the side effects, and the therapeutic effects. And also what the starting dose was, what the upper limit of the dosing was. So all these things. So I would go home every night to my itty-bitty apartment, and I would memorize about 75 drugs a night. And that's what I would do. I would memorize these drugs. And so one day I came to the pharmacology class, and the professor was talking about this drug, dipyridamole. It's actually making a comeback. And this is a drug that was back then prescribed as a blood thinner to reduce the frequency of stroke and heart attack. And at the point I entered medical school, it had just been proven to be ineffective, but it was still recommended we give it as part of the standard of care. Because, of course, research was ongoing. And so the professor was talking about this drug, and he got through with his discussion about how useless it was and how we should use it anyway. And at the end of the lecture, he looks up, and we have these seats that kind of elevate, like a sports arena. And he waves his hand at the drug rep and says, "Hey, drug rep, did I get that right? Did I say that okay?" And the drug rep says, "Yeah, you did fine." I said, wait a minute. I thought we were getting an impartial education here where we would know what to do on behalf of the patient without any undue influence and could protect the patient's interest against possible biases like drug companies, for example. And so that was a little disturbing, but I made my mind that, well, I didn't have to be biased. And so then another thing, which is a little disturbing, and I wrote this little comment, kind of as an update. It's a more of a modern thing, so you can kind of appreciate it. It's called Keeping Up with the Times. And so back in 1982, when I was in medical school, this is what the professor said. Aspirin is only on the market because there was no Food and Drug Administration to ensure safety back then. It is not safe, and many ignorant people, patients, are using it. Unfortunately, we cannot undo this tragedy. And so all the medical students said, oh. And fast forward to 2012, and aspirin, once a day, improves heart health. It saves lives. This is FDA approved, and you should recommend it to your patients. And of course, medical students said, wow. And so this is the nature of medical education. If something is in the public domain, being used by patients freely, without any particular profit for the industry, then it's condemned. Once it becomes profitable and accepted by the industry, it becomes the standard of care. Now, another thing we're taught in medical school is what is proof? What constitutes proof or evidence? And so, of course, for this, we were introduced to statistics. And one concept, which is hard-clad and cast in concrete, is that when you have two events, and you're told the first event gives rise to the second event, if the first event gives rise to the second event in fewer than 5% of cases, we say the events are statistically unrelated and there is no association. So the joke goes, student, which would be me, says, the laws of statistics apply to heart attacks too? And the professor says, they certainly do. And the student says, a heart attack is deadly in 4% of cases. Does this mean that heart attacks statistically do not cause death? And the professor says, I didn't say that. You can imagine another strike, another question that shouldn't have been asked. And so it was really weighing on me, all of these things I noticed that really weren't quite adding up. The chat room says 5% seems sort of arbitrary. It's not sort of arbitrary. It is arbitrary. And so it turns out statistics you have things with a 95% confidence interval. There's t-values and tails, and the arbitrary size of the tail is 5%. So the tail, that means the amount of area under the curve after a certain cutoff, if that area is 5%, so whatever you're measuring is not statistically influential on the outcome that you're observing. And so, just for the sake of listeners, only 4% of all heart attacks are deadly, just by the way. And in case you're spending a lot of time trying to prevent one, only 4% of heart attacks are deadly. That means on average, you need to have 25 heart attacks or 24 heart attacks, which will not be deadly, before the 25th one, which will be deadly. Very interesting. So, just for your information. Now, something else happened in medical school that first year. Actually, this is later on, second, third year. There's something called dermatology day. Okay. Now, there are probably those of you listening who have a rash of some sort. That's okay. You don't have to confess. You don't have to raise your hand. And so in medical school, I found it very confusing. I did not see where these rashes were getting better with our treatment. And so I was really excited to go to dermatology day where I felt I was going to get some answers. And in dermatology day, some very generous human beings volunteer to sit in a glass booth, which is four glass booths, and display their rashes and have a sign in front of them describing what their rash is. And this is the comic strip. So the instructing physician says, look carefully at each rash. These patients have been treated for years, and each year they generously volunteer to display their rash to enhance your education. And so two medical students are looking at these people who are on display in these glass booths. And the first person has psoriasis, and he says, I've been volunteering for 5 years now. I hope they find a cure soon. And the second person, who obviously has tinea versicolor, says, this rash keeps coming back. Glad my doctor's a specialist. The third person says, does rash all over his chest, severe cystic acne in his face too? Maybe I can get a date if they fix this rash. And then the final guy has a bad case of eczema. He says, I can't stand it anymore. Please help me. And so these two medical students are talking. And the first medical student says, well, it's pretty easy. If it's wet, dry, if it's dry, wet it. And if it's red, it's steroids. And the second person says, well, if the rash, if the stuff we're giving them works so well, how come they still have the rashes? The first student says, shh. And the second one says, just saying. And so this is the kind of things that we were confronted with throughout medical school. And very subtly like this, basically, you know, we're not curing anything. People aren't getting cured. In fact, we're not even getting better. And so this is being introduced little bit by little bit, slowly by slowly, bit by bit. And each, as time goes on, medical students get deeper and deeper in debt. I just checked the internet, and school I went to is $35,000 a year, which is a pretty real bargain. Yale Medical School is up there at $50,000 a year. And so with each passing semester, the student incurs more and more debt. Now, when I went, under a program where I agreed to work in an underserved area for each year that the government paid for my education. But if at any point I decided to drop out of medical school, I would owe the government, due and payable immediately, $250,000. $250,000. And back then, $250,000 was a lot of money. I had a big, huge financial incentive to stick this out, this whole experience. And so then we come to, so here we are, wringing our hands and worried about how this just doesn't seem to be turning out so cool for the patients. And then comes the Hippocratic Oath. Well, we have the Hippocratic Oath. Now, the Hippocratic Oath has changed over the years. I figured I would look this up so I could give you guys a straight poop on the Hippocratic Oath. Now, the Hippocratic Oath in the old days said, do no harm. Now, the Hippocratic Oath has been altered to say, first, do no harm. When I went to medical school, the Hippocratic Oath was, first, do no harm. And I personally believe it's this interpretation of the Hippocratic Oath that it has really permitted medicine to become so lethal. In other words, first you do no harm. Then, after you do no harm, you're free to do all the harm you want. And at no point are you obligated to in any way help, assist, or improve the patient. Which is, of course, very shocking. Let's take a look at this hypothetical. It says, I swear by Apollo the physician, in Asclepius and Hygiene, and Panacea, and all the gods and goddesses, as my witness, that according to my ability and judgment, I will keep this oath and this contract. Now, I want you to notice how the contract starts out. I hold him who taught me the art equally dear to me as my parents, to be a partner in life with him, and to fulfill his needs when required, to look upon his offspring as equal to my own siblings, and to teach them this art, if they shall wish to learn it, without fee or contract, and that by the set rules, lectures, and every other mode of instruction, I will impart a knowledge of the art to my own son and those of my teachers, and to students bound by the command, contract, and having sworn this oath to the law of medicine, but to no others. Did you hear me mention anything about patients? No. The patients do not come first. Come first is whoever taught you the craft, and their son, and your son. Then we get around to the patient. Okay. I will use those dietary regimens which will benefit my patients according to my greatest ability and judgment, and I will do no harm or injustice to them. Now, this has been changed to first do no harm, which means second, third, and fourth, you're open to harm. I will not give a lethal drug to anyone if I am asked, nor will I advise such a plan. Now, this is important. You will not give a lethal drug if you are asked. What if you're commanded? In other words, if a patient asks you for a lethal drug, you'll refuse. But what if your instructor teaches you a protocol that involves a lethal drug? Even if they don't tell you the drug is lethal, will you do it? This does not exactly prohibit that. Nor will I advise such a plan. And similarly, I will not give a woman a pessary to cause an abortion. Now, I know there's a lot of views on abortion out there, but let's put those aside for a minute. Back then, in the time of Hippocrates, abortions were uniformly deadly. The patient was going to die. And so that's why this prohibition on abortion. In purity and according to divine law, I will carry out my life and my art. I will not use a knife, even upon those suffering from stones. Again, cutting for stones was uniformly deadly back then. Now, routinely, they do surgery for stones, kidney stones. But I will leave this to those who are trained in the craft. Into whatever homes I go, I will enter them for the benefit of the sick. Okay, you can scratch that off, because now doctors are not permitted to do house calls for the most part. Avoiding any voluntary act of impropriety or corruption, including the seduction of women and men. In other words, they're not going to have sex with the men or women in the homes where they go, whether they are free men or slaves. Whatever I see or hear in the lives of my patients, whether in connection with my professional practice or not, which ought not to be spoken of outside, I will keep secret and consider all such things to be private. So long as I maintain the oath faithfully and without corruption, may it be granted to me to partake of life fully and the practice of my art, gaining the respect of all men for all time. However, should I transgress this oath and violence, may the opposite be my fate. Okay. Now, this oath does not place the the patient at the center of care, number one. Number two, this oath in no way compels the physician to respect the wishes of patients. And finally, the oath is to the professional and to people who taught this person the art. That is it. So this oath totally frees the doctor to act in his own interest. I'll give you an example of this. This is, again, another comic called Do No Harm. These two ladies are having lunch together. And the first lady says, I am glad my doctor is certified in the Hippocratic Oath. And the second one says, you are so lucky. So many people are getting sick from medical care. So the first one says, yes, he's really an expert. I've had my tonsils, appendix, gallbladder, and uterus removed. I don't feel any better, but I simply don't feel any worse. And secondly, he says, more doctors should do no harm. Is your doctor taking new patients? And this is really what it has come to, is we have doctors who are following the Hippocratic Oath and who are recommending therapy that does no harm, but it sure doesn't do any good. And so the Hippocratic Oath for me was a serious letdown when I read it. It was really a disappointment. I thought that, you know, like, wow, this is great, you know, I'm going to be a doctor, and I can help patients achieve their life goals by being healthy so they can do whatever they want with their newfound health. That is not what the Hippocratic Oath says. So you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniel at RainbowSoulBlakeRadio.com. And by the way, Vitality Capsules are absolutely sold out. There is not another bottle of Vitality Capsules in the warehouse. But our second order is, our next order rather, is being manufactured. It should be ready in 2 to 3 weeks. But do go to VitalityCapsules.com, sign up on the notification list, and so we'll notify you when they're back in stock. Okay, back to our regularly programmed thing here. And so this for me was very, very troubling. But again, I was trained in the old days. We had something called medical judgment. And so I could use something called medical judgment. If I felt something was not good for the patients, I was free to not do it. And so that kept me moving right along in medical school. Also, when I went to medical school, I had a list of things I needed to take care of. Well, first, I wanted to practice family medicine. And back in the inner city ghetto where I grew up, so that was like another one on my list. And then I had a bunch of people in my family who were quite ill. I had my father at the time had developed osteosarcoma, cancer of the bone. He also was diabetic. I had two sisters who were mentally retarded. I had another brother who was a drug addict. I think that's it. And I was looking for something in medical school. I had a list. Something that would take care of these problems. Oh, my mother had chronic pain from a car accident, as well as allergies and sinus problems. And so I had a whole list. And I was looking in medical school for methods they had for treating some of these conditions so that with my degree, of course, that would be nice, but I could graduate with some solutions to some very real problems the people in my family were having. So the next thing we were going to medical school was the concept of watch or wait in. Now, I was shocked. You mean we have conditions that we can diagnose that we don't have any treatment for, no way of improving or benefiting the patient. We have to wait, watch the patient and wait until it deteriorates, and then we can offer therapy? We don't have anything to offer him to keep him from getting worse? This really shocked me, but this is so let's talk about watchful waiting. And so I was talking to a doctor, another comic strip that I wrote, and the patient says, doctor, what do you recommend for my prostate condition? The doctor said, the standard of care recommends watchful waiting. And the patient says, well, what's that? And the doctor says, this means I get paid to watch while you wait. And that's about what it comes down to. So we were actually instructed to have people come back every 3 to 6 months for a check so we could just watch them. like, oh my God, that is like a serious abuse of people's time and resources and everything. I mean, that's not going to help anybody. But again, that didn't go over very well. So, what happened then was we were taught all these incredible interventions that we could do. You know, we could screen for this, we could screen for that, we could get this drug, we could get that drug. And so, okay, great. What else was the outcome? How do patients do when we give them these drugs? And we were told that they do pretty well. These drugs are great. They're the standard of care. They've been proven by research. And one student raised his hand and said, Dr. Senior, these drugs are so good. These therapies are so innovative. We should pass laws making everybody take these therapies. Well, the doctor just about passed out. Face got pale. He was horrified. He said, no, never. Nobody should ever be forced by law to accept any therapy of any kind. Well, just the whole point of the place had chills through everyone. So, well, of course, there's a follow-up question. Well, why not? And so the doctor regained his composure, thank God, and said, the standard of care changes so quickly based on research that we can't legally compel legal therapy of any kind because law can't be changed as fast as research progresses. And so we all said, oh, okay, all right. So we were placated at that point. Now, the one thing that's really is we always talk about heart attacks and getting quick care for heart attacks. And they've done some studies lately about getting someone who has a heart attack from the emergency room door into the cardiac cath room to pass a tube up their arteries into their heart to inject medication or whatever to intervene in the system. What they found was it did not improve outcome one bit if therapy was delayed by an hour. So here's a joke about that. The lady says, well, I don't want to die because I didn't get to the hospital in time. The doctor says, not possible. Delay improves survival. And the lady says, you mean those long waits in the emergency room are good for my health? And guess what? It is. And another thing we're taught in medical school, which I found distressing, was we were taught when a patient came in with one condition to diagnose as many unrelated conditions as possible and give them drugs. And so here's a joke about that. The lady says, doctor, I have a vaginal discharge. The doctor says, sounds like depression to me. Here's a prescription for new loss. And then things hit a real low point around the third year of medical school. It was clear that these patients were not doing well. And so they had to pull out the big guns. And I'm telling you, the medical school curriculum could have been written by the MK Ultra guy. And this is what happened. They gathered all the students together in a very important meeting. And they said, well, we have to tell you. And this comic strip is labeled Half Baked. And as the senior doctor says, 50% of everything you're learning is false. Every 4 years, another 50% will be determined to be false. This is why continuing education is so important. And so the medical student sitting on the seat of the seat, that would be me, sitting down, listening to this. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Told me after graduation, 93.75% of what I'm learning will be false. If it is false 12 years from now, isn't it false today? And Dr. Senior says, this is what he really said to me, Dr. Duguid, I think you're reading too much into this. In other words, my brain was overactive. Now, in medical school, what they do when you come in is the first thing they do is immunize you. And of course, I skipped the immunization because I didn't like needles, and no one tracked me down. So that's one thing they do to you. So I didn't have that mental impairment to work against. The next thing they do is they sleep deprive you. Really, you're working on 90 hours a week of work and not much sleep. In my case, my finances were so strained that I was also eating every other day. So when you have one under this kind of stress, usually the mental activity is not great. And it's all they can do to just accept whatever they're told. And so it's really pretty shocking to people that I asked questions. But I was very polite when I asked these questions. I never, you know, questioned the underlying basis of what was said. I just found this curious. The one thing I learned in medical school, we learned about the referral. What's the referral? It means with a standard of care, at some point in the standard of care, step 5, 6, or 7, you refer the patient to a specialist. A specialist is someone who knows, well, more than you do. And someone who is certified and trained to use far more dangerous drugs. And because of their training, presumptively, they get much better outcome with these very dangerous drugs than you were able to get with the less dangerous drugs. And so here is a comic strip I wrote about that. So you have a doctor and a patient. The doctor says, Mr. Smith, we are now at the 7th step in the standard of care. This is when I refer you to the specialist. And the patient says, will the specialist make me better? And the doctor says, you would be the 10th person I have referred. Nobody has gotten better yet. And the patient says, then why would I go? And the doctor says, well, it's the standard of care. And this is about 90% of what's practiced. Doctors refer patients, they do a lot of tests, just because it's the standard of care. And at no point do they promise the patient any relief, but they do everything to give the impression that there is relief there. And that's exactly what we are encouraged to do in medical school. And another thing that happens in medical school is the medical students are instructed to do certain things or write certain words in charts. And so this is a comment of a medical student sitting in the seat of the seat, and he's talking to a doctor. And a medical student says, we've used this protocol in 50 patients. They've all died. Can we stop? The doctor says, a recent study published in the EWE, that's EWE, England Journal of Medicine, shows statistical evidence that patients benefit from this protocol. There is no reason to doubt this. Dr. Duguid, your lack of confidence in scientific fact is disturbing. And of course, this is in the ICU, which is the intensive care unit. And this is the type of intimidation that students are subjected to. And you can imagine, you've got a student who's eating every other day, darn near starving to death, who's facing a $250,000 fine if they decide to walk away from this nonsense. Or even worse, the student is taking on loans, compounding daily, and he meets this level of intimidation. And obviously, if you observe the protocol to not work in 50 consecutive patients, your observations would have to at some point supersede something you read in the medical journal, you would think. You would think. Now, another thing that happened in the past 30 years is CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation guidelines, changed. And the guidelines in the 80s was ABC, airway breathing circulation, airway breathing circulation, get that airway, get the air, open the airway, get the air in, and get it circulating. And so we were taught, must open the airway, breathe in the air, and pump in the chest, circulate the air. And we were told, without airway and breathing, circulation is useless. And this is the 80s. Oh, yeah, 80s. Fast forward to 2000-something. And we're instructed, doctors are instructed, forget airway and breathing. Only chest compressions are needed. And so the medical student says, why the change? And the doctor says, this may not save lives, but the organs remain fit for transplantation. And so by then, of course, things were going downhill. This was 30 years of medical school. And so it's getting very discouraging. Nothing is working. And the way protocols are written is you do step 1. If that doesn't work, you go to step 2. If that doesn't work, you go to step 3, 4, 5, 6. And so I got to the point where I would go to step 1 and then 2 and then skip over to step 7 and 8 because we all the steps in between have never worked anyway, so why put the patient through it? And so these are the things we were trained as doctors to say to people. You want to get better, don't you? I want you to be around for a long time. Take this. This procedure must be done. This is an emergency. Take this medication the rest of your life. This is life-saving therapy. Research shows this is your best option. So all these things we're taught to automatically spit out and just say to the patient to convince them or get them to submit. And so this is really, to me, shocking. I thought, well, geez, why can't I just give patients the same information that I have as a medical student and let them make a decision? And so we were cautioned that patients wouldn't know how to handle this information. And so I'm going to take a little detour here and give you some information about how you might want to handle these things to keep from becoming a casualty in the very serious war going on U.S. soil that's murdering 860,000 Americans a year. So you may hear doctors say things like, this is your only hope. You must follow the standard of care. One possible reply is, thanks, Doc. I purchased my hope at the cosmetics counter. How about something effective? And another thing is, doctor might say, this is your only hope. You must follow the standard of care. Another answer is, hope? You're not God. I get my hope at church. I'm here for results. And here's another one, doctor might say, this is your only chance. You must follow the standard of care. Another answer might be, no thanks, Doc. I place my bets at the last chance casino. Or, another one, doctor might say, this is our only chance. You must follow the standard of care. And you can say, no thanks, Doc. I'd rather not play games of chance with my health. These are all things that will definitely get your doctor to stop and think. And maybe even kill the next patient instead of you. And so it's this next joke. So I sit down and crunch these numbers and sort through it. I actually went to, the dean of students was actually calling me to his office rather frequently. One time I ended up in his office and we were chatting. And I said, hey, back then I didn't use numbers, so for the sake of the construct, I'm using numbers. Say, 93.75% of what I'm being taught is false. Can't you guys form a truth-finding committee, cut medical school to 4 months, and just teach the 6.75% that's true? And so the comments just, the senior doctor that I had was, ugh, look. And so finally, it occurred to me that I was being taught a bunch of lies. And finally, it occurred to me that the list of diseases on my list that I had come to medical school to find an answer to, that the answers to my questions were not to be found in medical school. And this hit me one day like a ton of bricks. And so I just picked up the phone and I called my mother, who had suffered chronic pain for, at that point, 30 years, telling her there's no cure here, Mom. And so here I am sitting in the seat of the seat, this is a comic strip I wrote, and I'm calling home and I said, Mom, I'm depressed. I want to drop out of medical school. My mother said, oh, honey, hang in there. We need you to become a doctor so you can make us all healthy here at home. And I said, that's the problem. They just told us we're being taught a path of lies. Of course, my mother had no answer to that. And my father said, it's just a license to kill. What does she expect? There I was, trying to get to medical school with that kind of backup and support. So my parents decided they had a real tragedy, a real crisis on their hands. Then I was very depressed, very unhappy with medical school. And they just couldn't allow me to throw my future away in such a whim, just a mood swing, you know? And that surely things were not as bad as I said. It just appeared that way to me at the time because of my frame of mind. And so my two parents lived in this ghetto, inner city Syracuse, got together and hatched this plan. They decided they would give me a one-week Caribbean vacation for two to get my mind off this. And so Mom calls me up with this plan. And she says, well, what about that? What if we just take a week off? Take a week off and we know you'll feel better. You'll feel different. I said, well, I sure could use, get away from here. But I get all these classes and a couple of exams. Let me go talk to my professors. And so I talked to my professors and managed to clear out a week. And then I was devastated to realize I didn't even have anyone I wanted to go with. So I invited Mom to go with me and flew us west of the Bahamas for a week. I came back. I had more energy. Still thought there was something wrong, but well, what are you going to do? So another thing that doctors are trained, part of this whole MK Ultra experience, and part of being able to be an effective serial killer, is to have absolutely no sympathy for the patient. Blame the patient for absolutely everything. And if anything goes wrong, it's because the patient is bad. And if the patient dies, it's because, of course, you deserve to live that much. You really have been living. And so, to complete this PSYOP, we were trained using welfare patients. And welfare patients came to the free medical care clinic. And they had to show up to the free medical care clinic with some regularity, or they wouldn't get what they really needed, which was a check to buy food and have a place to stay. And we were trained that welfare recipients, you know, generally, you know, they're not perfect people, and maybe there are some welfare cheats in there and some that don't deserve the care we're giving them, but we kind of have to give care to all of them. And some of them might be malingering, but that's okay, too. We've got to do the best we can. And sometimes they don't always get good results because, of course, they don't follow instructions. So we have this whole thing, this picture painted of this welfare recipient as a bad person. And so in the comic, the welfare recipient walks out the clinic and goes in one direction. Doctor walks out the clinic and goes another direction. The welfare recipient says, I've been coming to this clinic for years, and I'm still sick. Something's wrong. And the doctor walks out the clinic and says, 6 more months of taking care of these welfare cheats, and I'll be certified in the standard of care in making the big bucks. So what we have here is what's going on is the doctor who's defrauding the patient by providing ineffective care. The patient's being blamed, and the doctor feels extremely superior. And it's the doctor, this whole welfare interaction, who's walking away with his future earnings of lots of money, and the patient walks out no healthier and no wealthier than when he came in. So it's clear that the welfare system is set up. Who's this, in this case? The doctor. I mentioned this to one of my classmates. And we actually were pretty good friends until I mentioned this to her. And she was very upset. So what happened was we were talking one afternoon, and she said, Jennifer, how come blacks are on welfare and don't work and just take stuff from the government all the time? Said, well, I'm not one of those people, but let's take a look at what we are doing here. You know, we welfare patients. You walk in the room, they walk in the room. They walk in sick, they walk out sick. You walk in poor, at the end of 4 years, you walk out with a big paycheck, bright future, and a certificate. Who's really on welfare here? And she said, Jennifer, you're a nice person, but sometimes you can be really off base. And this is the training of that. And every now and then in medical school, we have the misfortune of overhearing conversations between doctors go something like this. Did you see how quickly Dr. Smith's patient died? Suspicious. And the second doctor said, yes, I use the standard of care. That way, no one ever suspects. And so, the problem then is that the doctors, step by step, bit by bit, are seduced into understanding that it's okay to murder patients. And that's just what we do. And it's all a matter of how you do it. We only have 5 minutes left, so if people have questions, you can put them in a chat room or click your button there and I'll answer them. We only have 5 minutes. I know you guys must have thought of some questions based on what I'm saying. I know it's not quite ordinary knowledge. So while I wait for questions, I'm going to continue. So a lot of stuff happened in medical school. And one thing that happened, every now and then there was a patient hanging on, just about to die, and who just had a moment of clarity. And this is one such patient. I cleaned up the interactions, it wasn't so bad, but the patient actually insulted the doctor and was very abusive, actually verbally. But the patient says, Doc, I know you're doing the right thing, but I'm feeling worse. And the doctor says, don't worry, you're receiving the standard of care. And the patient says, is there another standard we can use? because the patient realized that he was getting worse and worse and worse. And the next thing is golden hour. The golden hour is the first hour after the patient encounters medical therapy. It can be the ambulance ride, it can be whatever, but the golden hour. And so we're taught in medical school, the first hour after a heart attack is called the golden hour. The patient must get medical attention within the golden hour. So student said, well, why is it called the golden hour? Professor said, revenue per patient can exceed his weight in gold if medical intervention is started in the first hour. And that's true. The sooner the medical care is started, the bigger the business. Because if you delay an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, the patient will improve on their own, and then you won't have any of the medical reason to intervene. So we're told we absolutely must intervene, quickly. And then this is something that actually really did happen. I was talking to a doctor. And so I said, well, Dr. Senior, we have followed the standard of care in this patient's case. Should we stop the medication? The patient's not getting better. The patient's getting worse. The doctor said, no. And so the next day, I said, Dr. Senior, I think the patient is dying. Should we stop the medication? Dr. Senior said, no. The standard of care tells us we would die sooner of the disease we are treating. It is far better that he died from the treatment. So I said, oh. And Dr. Senior says, I can see you will require more training to become competent in the standard of care. I won't go into the details of it, but they actually attempted to keep me in medical school longer. I managed to circumvent that and graduate with my call. But students who ask questions are definitely singled out and can be very uncomfortable. Okay, we have a question here. Let me see if I can click the right button. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Your question?
This is Chris Lewis. I'm calling from West Hartford, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I had a question for you regarding, you said the water that you drink when you're doing the preparation for taking turpentine has to be more acidic.
Yeah, you can't do 8 or 9. It's not going to work.
So
I'm
getting spring water delivered from like a natural spring to my home.
Yeah.
And I started that like a couple months ago. So I was just wondering, like, is natural spring water, if it's bottled like at the source, like is that not really like appropriate for doing the turpentine?
Yeah, it's not really appropriate because with the chemtrails and all the stuff going on in the water and air and rainfall, spring water is not what it used to be. If you have a company delivering spring water, you can just give them a phone call and say, hey, can you give me some reverse osmosis water for a couple of weeks? And then they can switch you back to spring water. Yeah, just give them a call. Those companies that do spring water, they usually carry a reverse osmosis product. So tell them you want RO for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, great.
I think.
You're welcome. Okay. We have two more minutes. So what happens is medical school progresses, and around the third year, the students, instead of talking about how to cure anybody or getting them better, everyone's talking about their loans. Everyone's talking about how they're going to repay their loans. And so it changes the whole atmosphere at the medical school. And so here's the conversation. The professor says, I understand you're considering dropping out of medical school. The student says, yes. And Dr. Senior says, we are committed to your success. Tutoring can be arranged. And the student says, it's not that. The stuff I am learning is so obviously useless. No adult competent to sign checks would submit to it. How can I ever practice medicine? And the professor says, oh, don't worry. That's why there's health insurance. You get paid whether the patient lives or dies. And the student says, okay, now that I know I can pay my loans, I'm okay with it. And this is really what medical school was, is, and has become. And so now we have students being taught to be expert insurance collectors. Do what you have to do to get the insurance company to pay. And unfortunately, that amounts to deadly protocol and becoming the secret force on U.S. soil that's killing Americans. That's it for today, and we'll see you again next week.